Hannah Kawas is a Palestinian Christian writer and broadcaster. He's been living in Vancouver with his wife and children since 1974. For the last 15 years, he has hosted the program Voice of Palestine on Vancouver Co-op Radio. As he explains in part one of this four-part interview, his family lived for several thousand years in the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, the land we know as Palestine. They were among the original mixed Arab and Hebrew worshipers of Jesus Christ. He spoke to me from his home in Vancouver. The war between the Israelis and Palestinians is often portrayed as a religious war. It seems to be one of those things that everybody just knows about it. Do you think it's a religious war?
No, I don't think it's a religious war. It's a colonialist, really, venture that started in the late 19th century when Herzl wanted to establish a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. And the basic aspects of that movement, which is called the Zionist movement, was to really colonize the land and send settlers to occupy the land. And this happened in spite of the presence of the Palestinian people, which included Jews and Christians and Muslims. So it was an attack on the rights of all Palestinians, this movement.
It's been said that the history of the land, that land between the Jordan River and the sea, has two narratives, the Israeli one and a Palestinian one. Is it possible that there are more narratives than that? You talk about Christians as well.
Yeah. When we talk about Palestinians, that includes the perspective of the Christian Palestinians. And the Palestinian Christians could be from the Hebrew tribes too. So, you know, the claim that the Jews are going back to their homeland is false, in essence, because many Jews are not from the Hebrew tribes.
And some of the Christians are, is that right? I guess when I imagine Christians in the Holy Land, I think of Christians who've returned or gone there from Europe.
I'm talking about the original Christians who stayed in the land. I'm talking about the first believers in Christ who are from Arabic background, Arabic origin, or Hebrew origin, who stayed on the land. And they were the guardians of the holy places for the last 2,000 years.
Just to clarify a point about the language of this, when you say Arabic, my understanding is that you're referring to people who speak the Arabic language. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And the people who are originally from the Arab Peninsula who came and settled in Greater Syria, and these were some Christians who believed in Christ, and they mixed with the people there. Aramaic was the original language of the inhabitants, but it then changed, and there is lots of people who are from the Aramaic ancestry, who Aramaic was the language of Jesus Christ too, and lots of people think it is the Hebrew that Christ was speaking, but that was misconception. It was the Aramaic language, and most inhabitants now, although there is no pure race, but most inhabitants who stayed in that area are mixed of Arabs and Hebrews and Aramaic people. So, and they mostly Semites tribes, because Arabs are Semitic tribe, and the Arabic language is a Semitic language. Like the Hebrew.
Here comes another word that I think maybe need a little bit of a gloss. How is Semitic different from Arabic or Hebrew?
Yeah, Semitic includes the Arabic and the Hebrew. because Semitic is not just one nationality. It's more than one. And it goes back to Sam in the Bible, who had many children, and then they developed into different tribes, basically.
I see.
Yeah. So it's really Semites are, you know, when you refer to Semites, you go to the Sam in the Bible.
And it's a larger group than Arabs or Jews.
Jews are not Semites.
Jews are, oh, okay, sorry.
Jews are not Semites in the sense that many European Jews, the majority of European Jews are not from Semitic origin. They are not from the Hebrew tribe. So there is this misconception, but I mean, we don't object on the using of the term anti-Semitic because it became a term that refers to anti-Jewish feeling or anti-Jewish hatred in Europe. But essentially, this term is misleading because. You know, it's more appropriate to say anti-Jewish hatred or anti-Jewish feeling rather than anti-Semitic. But again, this is not really an issue. But to go back to the main subject that, you know, and this is what the Zionists are trying to say, you know, that all Jews are from Semitic origin and they are all from Hebrew background, which is nonsense and it doesn't hold water. They use this logic to convince the world and the Jews, because most Jews didn't believe in going back to Palestine and establish a Jewish state.
Let's talk about you a little bit more.
Okay.
Where were you born? Were you born in Palestine or in?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was born in Bethlehem. And, you know, my ancestry goes way back in history because, you know, I could be of a Hebrew origin because, you know, my ancestors have been there for thousands of years. And, you know, the Christians who are now in the Holy Land are people who stayed on their belief and who kept their belief in spite of all the invasions that happened from the Romans to the Greeks to the Muslim invasion. Many Christians became Muslims during the 5th or 6th century when the spread of Islam happened. But for sure, the people who stayed Christians are from, you know, their roots go way back. And many, many, many Muslims are from Christian backgrounds or from either Hebrew or Arabic background. Because there were Christians, the Ghassans tribes in the greater Syria were from Arabic background and they were Christians. And in addition to the original Christian in that area. So I can't really tell you exactly from what background I am, but I could have been of a Hebrew background because most of the disciples of Christ were Hebrews, were Jews, basically, who believed in him and followed his teachings. So that doesn't apply to all Christians, mind you, because, you know, to generalize gives the Christians also a legitimate claim to Palestine.
Uh-huh.
If we want to follow the same Zionist logic.
So you were born in Bethlehem?
Yeah, I was born in Bethlehem.
Is the Church of the Nativity a church, the church that you would have attended? Is that?
Oh, yeah. I used to go to the Nativity Church when I was young as part of the... We belong to the Greek Orthodox Church, and it's the church that sits on top of the Nativity Church, basically. It's the main, you know, the cave where Christ was born is under the Orthodox Church. And we used to go there as part of the Boy Scouts. We used to have Boy Scouts, and basically be part every Sunday of, you know, guiding people and taking care of older people and, you know, like helping people in the church every Sunday.
Do you ever go back?
Not since 67. I left after the war, the Six-Day War in 67, and I never been back there. I was planning to go back after the Oslo was signed, and I applied for a passport, for my passport to be renewed, and the Canadian government refused to put my birthplace as Palestine, that I was born in Bethlehem, Palestine. I guess they know better than me where I was born. So,
where did they want to say you were born?
They wanted to say either Israel or Jordan, or they compromised to put nothing after Bethlehem. No country. But although I had my previous two passports that I get from the Canadian passport office stated that I was born in Bethlehem, Palestine, the same thing was with my visa when I entered the country. It stated that I was born in Bethlehem, Palestine. But, you know, after, I guess this is the dividends of the Oslo process, after they signed the Oslo process, they didn't want to recognize Bethlehem as Palestine. So I refused it, and basically I'm sitting here as a hostage to the passport office because they refused to put where I was born.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I wrote them many letters, and I have a booklet about the whole struggle with the Canadian government. And through it, I exposed the historic collaboration with the Zionist movement, the official Canadian government position, and their support for Israel and the establishment of Israel.
I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio, and I've just been talking to Hannah Cowis. That booklet Hannah was talking about is called Birthright Denied, Canadian Complicity in Palestinian Dispossession. It was published by the Canadian Palestine Association in June of 1999. You can get a copy by sending a $2 donation to CPA, Box 3255, Vancouver, BC, V6B3X9. I'll give that address one more time at the end of the hour, so you might want to go get a paper and pencil and you can write it down.
Well, I wanted to pursue that a little bit. I want to ask you how you would describe Canada's Middle Eastern policy.
It's totally biased. And it's in support of whatever Israel does. And this being the case since the partition plan, where Lester Pearson, who used to be the Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs, played a major role at the United Nations in drafting the partition plan and passing it at the United Nations. And basically his main objective was to establish the Zionist state in Palestine, because he was a Zionist a Christian, and he supported the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine.
I see.
And since then, the policies haven't changed. You know, if you go to the website of the Canadian Foreign Ministry, you see that the number one issue on the in the paper that related to the Middle East policy, number one is the security of the state of Israel, and not one word is mentioned about the security of the people of Palestine. And that gives you an indication about the really biased. And you know, recently we've seen it at many stages, whether at the United Nations, in December 8th, for example, Canada was at the Security Council and they blocked a resolution to send international observers to, you know, to protect the Palestinian people and to monitor the ceasefire. They blocked it. And again, recently, the Canada voted at the Human Rights Commission on Human Rights. At the UN Commission on Human Rights, they voted against censoring Israel
just
because of its violation of human rights in the occupied territories.
Uh-huh. Just to go back for just a moment, what year would that be that the partition plan was voted on? That
it was in 1947, November 29th, 1947.
So essentially just prior to the formation of the state of
Israel. Yeah, before, and the Israel gets its legitimacy from this plan, which allotted to 30% of the population, which were Jewish, after half a century of immigration and settler colonialism, allotted them 56% of the total area of Palestine, although they owned only 6% of the total area of Palestine at that stage. And through the war and expansion in 48, which started, by the way, before the British left in May 15th, the expansion of Israel and grabbing more territories than the more than the 56% started before even the British left, and the British didn't move to stop the Zionist gangs from occupying other Palestinian territories. And the, for example, the massacre at Deir Yassin, which forced many Palestinians to leave in terror, happened in April, April, I believe, 16 or 17, which is a month before the establishment of the State of Israel on May 15th. And they grabbed in 48, 78% of the total area of Palestine. They expanded the 56% to include another 22% of Palestine by the by force, basically military force.
Palestinians refer to this period of time as the Nakba, as the catastrophe. Is that pretty much the same for the Christian community as for the Muslim community?
Oh yeah, for sure, because we consider ourselves Palestinians, and we call it a Nakba, and we don't have any difference in the political concepts from our Muslim brothers and sisters, because we part of that nation. And taking note too that Israel didn't treat us differently. I was just reading today in 48 the story of two villages which are mostly Christians in North Palestine, Ikrit and Kfar Bur'am, where after they established the State of Israel, there was no fighting or anything. They entered the villages, and the Israeli army told the Christian population of these two villages to leave, because military reasons. And they asked them to leave these two villages, and then after that the population went to the High Court in Israel, and the High Court ordered the army to let them go back to their homes. So the response of the Israeli army was to bomb these villages, and the only structure was left in these villages was the church. And after that they gave the area to a settlement, to Israeli Jewish settlement. Until now they are fighting in Israeli courts to go back. So what I wanted to say is they treated the Palestinians, whether Christians or Muslims, the same way they were treating in general the Palestinian population. They didn't differentiate between Christian or a Muslim, as long as you are a Palestinian. And that's why when you asked me at the beginning if it's a religious war, I said no, it is not, because it wasn't. It's not a struggle between Christian and Jews. It's not a struggle between Muslims and Jews, as it's perceived in North America.
Let's talk a little bit about the Canadian media. How would you describe the Canadian media's response to the situation that you describe?
The Canadian media always been pro-Israel, and it reflects the opinions and the convictions of the state, basically. But recently, the last couple of years, it's more so than before. It's more pro-Israel than ever it was, although it's always been pro-Israel. I think this is due to the lack of competition and due to the concentration of the print media and even the TV ownership in the hands of one man, Israel Asper, and this being documented in many places, whether it's in the Gazette, in the Montreal Gazette, or many other papers like the Toronto Sun. And they had a policy not to criticize Israel editorially. And many journalists, I believe 56 journalists from the Gazette refused this kind of dictation and censorship. And many others resigned or quit the Izzy Asper empire. So it is worse than ever. And, you know, while you can criticize the Canadian government in your editorial, you can't criticize the state of Israel, which is really ridiculous, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's plain censorship and control of the media for personal reasons and personal political convictions.
I want to ask if there's something important that's been neglected by the press, and the situation that you describe makes it obvious that there must be lots that's been neglected by the press. What would you say is the most important thing?
The most important thing is the initial injustice that happened to the Palestinian people in 48. When they talk about the reaction of the Palestinian, they don't tell the people why the Palestinians are reacting that way or why they are resisting occupation and why they are opposing Israel. The initial injustice that happened in 48 basically uprooted three quarters of the Palestinians, and they made the Israelis made the three quarters of the Palestinians refugees. Now the number is over 4.5 million refugees. That's the largest refugee group in the world, and people ignore that and ignore that these people, these refugees, had homes, and there are many United Nations resolutions demanded Israel to let these refugees go back to their homes and be compensated for all the suffering they endured for the last 54 years. That's one thing. The other thing, they don't tell the public that in 48, the Israeli terrorist gangs and terrorist organizations, which became later the Israeli so-called defense forces, they demolished and wiped out over 400 villages and towns. They wiped them out from the face of the earth, basically, so they won't allow the people who left. Or sometimes they force people to leave and then they demolish these towns and villages, like in the case of Iqrit and Kfar Barhum, the two Christian towns in North Palestine. As I said, 400 is not really a joke. There was no media to report on what happened then. So people in general and in the media in the West ignores these facts, although, you know, they ignore them. They doesn't mean that they didn't happen, because they are in the hearts of every Palestinian, whether Muslim or Christian.
Hannah, in my own personal narrative, this story is about discovering actual people, mainly Palestinians, but Jews too, who were being hidden in this darkness of ignorance, this ignorance that comes in part from the propaganda and sometimes outright lies. It's taken a long time for the Palestinian people to emerge into the public's consciousness as actual people. Do you think that's happening, or am I dreaming?
First of all, I think let's differentiate a bit between the North American public or the Western public and the world public, because in the conscience of the world public in general, we've been on the conscience of these people for a long time, since 48, because many in the third world, Asia, Africa, and Central and South America, people knew what happened to the Palestinians. The only people who are misled because of the interest of the West in the Middle East are the North American people. And for many reasons, one of the main reasons is the alliance of the governments, of the Western government with Israel. They look at Israel as a military base for them in the Middle East to protect their interests, mainly oil, and to stop the growing nationalist movement in the Arab world and to suppress any democratic change in the Arab world. And the other thing is the media, which tries to brainwash people, again, because it represents the multinationals and the status quo in North America and in the West in general. So I'd say the Western public opinion been for a long time been brainwashed of what's really happening in the Middle East. I see lots of signs of change, and the change didn't happen just with this intifada. It started with the 1982 with the brutal invasion of Lebanon when Sharon was defense minister of Israel, and he was the architect of that invasion. And during that invasion, almost 30,000 Palestinian and Lebanese were butchered in cold blood, mostly civilians, during that invasion. And it culminated in the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, where the Israeli army entered Beirut and let the phalanges go into the refugee camps. And this was against an agreement which was brokered by Philip Habib, the American envoy, that was agreed upon with the PLO. And two conditions were met by Philip Habib from the PLO, that Israel shouldn't enter Beirut, and the second thing was the safety of the refugees in these refugee camps. And the Palestinians get this guarantee that Israel won't enter Beirut, and the second thing, that the Palestinian civilians in this refugee camp will be safe. America guaranteed that through Philip Habib, but we know after that what happened in 82. The Israeli army occupied Beirut, which is again, you know, they broke their word, and the Americans broke their word by allowing Israel to occupy Beirut, and the safety of the refugees wasn't guaranteed. Actually, a massacre happened, which was documented at Sabra and Shatila by many international organizations. So again, I think Israel and Sharon are not the only culprit in this massacre and in this, because the Americans signed to this deal and they carry a major responsibility for what happened in 82. But since then, I go back to my point, since then the Western public start changing their point of view about Israel and the misconceptions that it's the only democracy in the Middle East, etc., all that nonsense that the media was feeding the public. And with this intifada and the recent brutal Israeli occupation and massacres in the West Bank, especially at Jenin refugee camp, the West in general woke up to what's happening. And we find it really heartening that the support we are getting, we are not keeping up with what's with the amount of support that we getting from all over the Western world. It is huge and immense, and the international solidarity movement that went to Palestine is an indication of this support, and it shows that the North American people and the European people are not really happy with what their governments are doing. And if these governments are not going to send official United Nations troops to protect the Palestinians, they're going to do it themselves. And they did it. And we've seen that when they entered the headquarters of Arafat, and when they stormed the Nativity Church with food and basic supplies for the people who were surrounded and held hostage by the Israeli troops who were surrounding and desecrating the Nativity Church.
Hannah, you chair an organization that brings together people of various backgrounds, Arabic and Jewish, Christian, secular people, and others. Do you see any hope of cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians, or between Arabs and Jews?
Yeah, I think this is possible as long as there is a basic concept that all of us human beings are equal and we should be treated equally. As long as there is a Zionist ideology that promotes sectarianism and exclusiveness, I think peace is very remote and won't happen, because if you feel you are a superior, the same ideology like the Nazis, you can't really have peace with such people. And I'm talking about the Zionists. And when I talk about Zionists, doesn't mean I'm talking about Jews, because there is lots of Zionist Christians who are more supportive of Israel than many Jews. When we talk about cooperation and living together with Jews, this is visible, because most Jews are against the segregation, against the superiority of the Zionist ideology, and are against the atrocities that Israel is committing against the Palestinian people. So in that sense, I see a solution that include a just solution for the Palestinian people and coexistence. And that's what our objective is. I think the Israeli government at this stage made it impossible for a two-state solution. The B'Tselem just issued a report 2 days ago saying that the settler organizations, the Israeli settler organizations in the West Bank, control 42% of the total area of the West Bank. So what's left for the Palestinian people to build the state on? That's, it's simple math. It's 58%. And that's if Israel would give the 58%. Sharon doesn't want to give 58%. He's saying he'll give back 42% only of the West Bank. So it's not really viable state. It's not visible either. And the Palestinian people won't accept such a state that is going to be controlled in every way, economically, militarily, and even in municipal affairs, because, Israel controls the water, and they don't want to give up the water. So the Palestinians are not going to accept that. So the only visible solution that I can see is based on equality. And, the two-state solution is not really dead. If there is equality in dealing with the Palestinians in general, and I mentioned 2 examples from which is part of the Israeli law. One is the Jewish National Fund, which control 93% of the total area of Israel, control 93% of the land of Israel, and this land can't be sold to any Arab, whether Muslim or Christian. Not just can be sold, it can be leased even. You can't lease from the Jewish National Fund if you are a Christian or if you are a Muslim. So as long as there is a law like that discriminate against people because of their ethnicity or because of their religion, I don't think there's going to be peace or justice there. The other thing is the law of return, which is part of Israeli law, that allows any Jew, whether born in Palestine or not, any Jew from anywhere in the world, to become a citizen and can go back Recently, Sharon asked for 1 million Jews to go back to Israel and to be accepted immediately. At the same time, he refusing to accept any Palestinian, whether Muslim or Christian, to go back to their hometowns, whether in Jaffa, Haifa, or any other place in Palestine. So this is clear discrimination based on sectarianism and on religious fanaticism. So as long as these laws do exist within Israel, I don't think there's going to be peace, because peace should be based on treating each other as equals and as human beings and as people who are not less superior or more superior than the other.
You raise a question in my mind when you talk about the two-state solution being almost dead. There's a small group of people who still, or seems to me it's a small group of people who still talk about a single-state solution. Could you comment on that just briefly? Is that just a dead letter, or is that something that might realistically be considered?
Yeah, I think that's the only viable solution if we want to have really a democratic state in the area. Because when you talk about two-state solution, you are defining the Israeli state as a Jewish state. But I have a question for people who want to keep that Jewish majority in the Jewish state. If you want to keep the Jewish majority, you're going to have to try to reduce the Palestinian population. Again, when I say Palestinian, I include Muslims and Christians. You have to keep it down, either by reducing the birth rate or by expelling the Palestinians from Israel. The other thing, you want to count on other Jewish immigration to increase the Jewish population. But if they leave it as a natural development, the population, the demographic structure inside Israel, the Palestinians people who get the Israeli citizenship, who are counted as Israeli citizenship citizens, comprise 22% of the population. And you know, the estimates is between now and 2020, this population is going to become almost half or 50%. So if they become 50% in another 18 years, what Israel is going to do? You know, it's not going to be a Jewish state anymore if it's 51% of its population are Christians and Muslim Arabs. So what are they going to do? The only thing, either they're going to bring more Jewish immigration and force that into Israel, and by forcing it, they're going to have to instigate anti-Semitism all over the world, because that's the only way to get Jews to go to Palestine, is to instigate anti-Semitism. And they're doing that now by putting a dark mark on the Jewish people in general by associating the atrocities that the Israeli state and the Zionists are doing with the Jewish people. By doing that, they are creating hatred against the Jews all over the world, and it is planned to bring more Jews from all over the world. And the other solution would be is to try to ethnically cleanse the people who are in Israel now and who hold Israeli citizen. That's aside from the West Bank, because the whole plan that they are doing now is to try to ethnically cleanse the territories, the occupied Palestinian territories in the West Bank and Gaza, from its people by putting all sorts of military pressure, economic pressure, to force them out of their homeland.
I just wanted to ask about that. When you talk about the 22% Palestinians who will by 2020 be 50 or 51%.
Yes.
You're talking about Palestinian Israelis now, is that right? Palestinians,
yes. Yes.
Living inside the Green Line.
Yeah, and they hold the Israeli citizenship.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you think is the most important concrete step that could be taken on the path to peace in the Holy Land?
Yeah, I think the most important step is to have a society inside Israel where every citizen in it is equal, regardless of their ethnic background, their religion, or their ethnicity. Because if you don't do that, the time bomb will keep ticking. And that's what happened the last 54 years. Equality means equality means justice. Justice means peace. Without taking these steps, there'll never be peace in Israel-Palestine, because you can't treat other human beings in an inferior way and claim to be democratic, or to claim to be that you're gonna have peace, and this is just won't work, you know. The essential formula for any justice and a peaceful transition in anywhere in the world is to give equality and treat people equality, like what happened in South Africa. Without giving the South African black people equal rights, you won't have the peace that we had the last 10, 15 years after the apartheid system was abolished. That's the same thing in Israel. You will never have peace unless you have justice. You will never have justice unless you have equality. And this is essential, that the Jewish population of Israel start realizing that, and the same with the Jews all over the world. The majority of Jews recognize that you can't have really an exclusiveness and superior a society that calls for a superior race. They won't last forever, in spite of all the support they are getting as an Israeli state from the U.S. and the only superpower in the world. This won't last forever. The U.S. won't last forever. No empire lasted forever. So the only guarantee for peace and security for both people is equality.
Well, what can Canadians do then? I mean, apart from waiting for the American empire to do whatever it is that empires do, what do you hope that Canadians will do to help bring about this condition of equality and to bring about peace in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think it's essential for Canadians to be active in pressuring the Canadian government of stopping its support for Israel and stopping the tax deductions that goes in support of Israeli aggression. There, for your information, there are lots of Canadian Zionists from Jewish background who are going there and volunteering inside the Israeli army to suppress the Palestinian people. This shouldn't happen. They are Canadian citizens. They shouldn't be allowed to go and oppress other people. This is against United Nations resolutions that the Canadian government supports. The Canadian government says that the occupied territories are occupied territories and Israel should leave them. And they support 242 and 338, the United Nations Security Council resolution. So if they do so, they shouldn't allow Canadian citizens to go there and fight against an oppressed people and subjugated people who are under occupation.
Okay, hang on for just a minute. Could you just, for our listeners, could you elaborate on those two resolutions that you just mentioned? I frequently see UN resolutions enumerated and referred to, and it's really rare to have someone who knows what they are to explain what they state and what they mean.
Yeah, the 242 resolution was passed in 1967, just after the war, and in it the Security Council asked the Israel to leave the occupied territories, and that was in 67. Basically, this resolution been affirmed and reaffirmed all over again. 338 is affirming the first one, the 242, which was taken, I believe, in 68, a year later. But since then, Israel ignored this resolution and kept its occupation of the West Bank. And not just that, they kept grabbing land from the occupied territories. As I said, B'Tselem just issued a report saying that the settlers control now 42% of the West Bank, which is illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention. You can't plant settlers in occupied territories. You can't grab the land from the occupied territories. This is basic principle in the Fourth Geneva Convention.
B'Tselem is the Israeli human rights group.
Yeah, B'Tselem is the Israeli human rights. And they're the one who's saying that these Jewish settlers are grabbing almost 42%. Actually, to be exact, it's 41.9% of the West Bank, almost 42%. So, you know, I mean, you can't, the Palestinians won't accept that, that 42% of their land be kept under Israeli control, because it's, again, against any principle, whether it's for Geneva Convention or against United Nations Resolution. And the Arab people and the Palestinian people see this hypocrisy of the Americans. When Iraq occupied Kuwait, they forced them out in 6 months by military force. And while at the same time they're supporting Israeli occupation for the last 35 years, not just supporting it, they're giving the green light for the Israeli military to reoccupy the West Bank cities, as Bush did and his vice president did and his Powell, his foreign minister, did. So it's clear, you know, they are supporting this aggression, and the people see this hypocrisy. And you know, when Bush asks why people hate us, I mean, he knows why people hate him, and especially in the Middle East, because he's keeping Israeli occupation, he's allowing Israeli occupation to continue, and he's forcing dictatorships on the Arab people.
Jeff Halper said in an article on May 15th, just recently, that relations between Israel and the Palestinians now are back to where they were in the 1970s, trying to navigate a transition from a kind of municipal or colonial autonomy in Bethlehem and Ramallah and Hebron to some semblance of Palestinian independence. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think what happened the last 18 months really set the peace process back at least 20 years, like Jeff said, because with the Oslo process, lots of people became hopeful, including Palestinians. And Palestinians and Israelis were hopeful that there'll be a resolution. The Palestinian bargained in a good faith with sometimes stupidity too, because I think the Palestinians, when they signed the Oslo Accord, they thought that the Oslo Accord says that Israel shouldn't build settlements anymore, because in one article in the Oslo Accord was that both parties shouldn't change facts on the ground, which will jeopardize the final status negotiations. They didn't spell out the settlement as such, but I mean, from reading this thing, you know, building settlements is changing facts on the ground, which will jeopardize the final status negotiation, because the settlements was one of the final status negotiations issues. They were stupid because they didn't spell them out. Israel say that doesn't include settlements, you know, which is, you know, I mean, clear it does. But, you know, the Israelis in 7 years, from 93 to 2000 and to 2000, and during that 7 years, and according to Peace Now, the Israeli movement, Peace Now, they said Israel doubled the units of the housing units in the settlements, and they doubled the settlers. So it's clearly Israel violated, and they didn't want to abide by the Oslo Accord. The main objective of signing the Oslo Accord to the Israelis was to stop the First Intifada, which was costing them economically and militarily huge amounts of money, basically. And they felt they'll buy time with the Oslo process, which again, you know, I mean, you can't deceive the people forever. Although Arafat was trying to convince the Palestinian that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, the Palestinian figured, you know, he's not delivering. After 5 years of the Oslo process, there was supposed to be a Palestinian state, and all the issues in the final status negotiation was supposed to be finalized. That was in 1998. So after the passing of 2 years, the people figured, you know, the Israelis are not really interested in giving a Palestinian state to the Palestinian people. All they are doing is grabbing more land and putting more settlers. And then the provocative visit to Al-Haram al-Sharif, to the mosque in Jerusalem of Sharon, was the spark that sparked the new, or the Al-Aqsa Intifada, or the second Intifada, where, you know, thousands or ten thousand police officers came just to protect Sharon to enter the mosque, and a day later they murdered six protesters at the holy site. And this is what sparked the second Intifada. So Arafat didn't start the Intifada. He didn't control it to start with. And he's not controlling it now because the Palestinian people are fed up with Israeli arrogance and Israeli oppression.
How is a Canada-Palestine association responding to this deteriorating situation? Or maybe it's not a deteriorating situation. It sounds as though there are some things that are improving and some things that are getting worse.
Yeah. As a group, we've been doing grassroots work since 1980 as Canada-Palestine Association, where, you know, We responded to 1982 invasion through demonstrations and, you know, public awareness. But after the Intifada started, there was a larger group that's been formed, which we are in it as individuals, really, which is the Canada-Palestine Support Network, which has a website, and maybe people could, if they need to know more about what's happening locally, about the activities, they could go to the website, which is www.canpalnet.ca. And through that, they could even help in the support work by signing petitions. There is a statement now being circulated on the website to pressure the Canadian government to put pressure on Israel to end its occupation of the Palestinian territories. And there is already around 800 signatures on this petition. So it's important people do active work by, you know, educating themselves, by signing petitions, by speaking out, by writing to the politicians, by writing letters to the media, and by being involved, because I don't think the solution is going to come from these regimes that support Israel without pressure from the people in North America.
What do you hope for Palestine? Ultimately, what do you see as the future for Palestine? Yeah.
I hope that there'll be a democratic state in all of Palestine, where people are judged on their merits rather than their ethnicity or their religion. And this is a vision which we had and we shared with the people for the last 2,000 years, in spite of all the invasions that happened. The Palestinian people stayed on their land, and in spite of all the occupations, one of the worst was the Ottoman occupation that lasted 500 years, but the Ottomans gone and the people stayed, and I believe that the people will stay and they will establish a democratic society where tolerance and equality will prevail.
Okay. Hannah, I'd like to give you the last word. Is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't touched on? Anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I think it's important for every human being as part of this global village to be involved in fighting all injustices, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's against our native brothers and sisters here in North America, or whether it's against the people in Colombia or Central America or in Africa. I think it's important for all of us to be united and to support each other, and we should make our voice heard everywhere, and by our solidarity and unity, we could achieve that.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Jim.
I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio, and I've been talking to Hannah Cowis in Vancouver. Hannah mentioned a booklet earlier called Birthright Denied, Canadian Complicity in Palestinian Dispossession, published by the Canada-Palestine Association in June 1999. I'm going to give you that address again, I'm going to give you the address again so that you can get a copy for yourself if you like. Send $2, a $2 donation, to CPA, Box 3255, Vancouver, British Columbia, V6B3X9. That's V as in Vancouver, B as in British Columbia, V6B3X9.